Well, it's a great pleasure to be here at the women's class. Fantastic, there's the women's class again, isn't it? So sadhu to everybody for getting that on again. That's great. So what is the perfection of wisdom? Perfection of wisdom, the English term, and the Sanskrit term, pranya paramita. So I'll speak mainly, I'll use the English term, it's a bit easier to follow. Well, it could be one of three things, really, perfection of wisdom. It's a little bit sort of ambiguous. It could be a bodhisattva figure, a goddess, who would be called Pranya Paramita rather than the perfection of wisdom. You might have seen her, a golden figure. In fact, there she is on the cover of this book, golden figure. It could be a set of Mahayana Buddhist texts, teachings, the perfection of wisdom literature, the Pranyaparamita literature, or it could be one of the six perfections developed by the trainee Bodhisattva in the Mahayana tradition. So I was kind of guessing from what Vanaraja said that the focus was more on the latter, because I believe you've been looking at the six paramitas, the six perfections practiced by the Bodhisattva. But I'm also going to, talk about that. But I'm also going to refer to the perfection of wisdom literature, because I think it's relevant. Sadly, I'm not going to say anything about the goddess. So if you've come to hear about Pranyaparamita, well, she will be there through by inference or by sort of association, but not directly. But I thought I should clarify a few terms before I talk, because, well, some of you may or may not be familiar with some of the terms that I'm going to use. So forgive me if you are familiar, it's just revision in that case. Well, Mahayana Buddhism, Mahayana obviously is the great vehicle, the second phase of Buddhism, if you like, from about 500 years after the Buddha onwards. And the emphasis being on the other regarding aspect of the Buddha's teaching, which is very much personified in the Bodhisattva, the person of the Bodhisattva. And, well, certainly in the earlier development of the Mahayana, there was two main kind of directions, two main sort of schools, if you like, the Madhyamaka and the Yogacara. So the Madhyamaka is the one that we're going to be focusing on, because these teachings all come from that side, if you like, of the Mahayana teaching. The Madhyamaka emphasized very much the teaching of shunyata, which was literally emptiness, but you know, you can find other sort of synonyms for emptiness that I think that might sort of make I don't know, sort of appeal more to the imagination or even make more sense, because emptiness can sound more like something that got nothing in it or something, you know, kind of thing in that way. So we can understand emptiness or shunyata as no self or insubstantiality, or there's nothing fixed, or everything's a process. So it's not actually different from the Buddha's teaching of conditionality, conditioned co-production, but it's seeing it from a different angle and really emphasizing the insubstantiality element, the no-self element, and applying it ruthlessly to absolutely everything that we can possibly experience has no substance. It's completely open, if you like, the open dimension of being. And in particular, I mean, that all sounds fine, doesn't it? But I think it can be more interesting or feel more kind of alive if we think in terms of ourselves, that we, what we think of as ourselves, are insubstantial. There's absolutely nothing at all in us that's fixed or permanent. Absolutely nothing. when I was writing this, I sort of realised that I imagine that if we completely realise this fact for ourselves, if we were completely in tune with this and acted with this understanding that there's nothing within us that's fixed and permanent, then we'd have realised the perfection of wisdom. So that's it. But that's getting a bit ahead of ourselves, isn't it? You know. And it might sound obvious magnetic. You know, we kind of know that. We kind of know that the Buddha taught that all things are insubstantial, that there's no fixed self, anatman, etc. But I find it quite interesting to try and apply it to myself. And it can be quite interesting, particularly, I think, to try and apply it to oneself when you're having something big going on, some sort of strong feeling of some sort, strong emotion. You might be upset or angry or whatever. And at that point, just try introducing the idea that you don't have a fixed and permanent self and see how you get on with that. But honestly, it is quite an interesting thing to sort of bring in. I was recently on a retreat where one of the things that we were encouraged to do in meditation was to try and identify where our self was, to look for the self, if you like. And at one particular sit that I was having, I thought, it's here, it's my heart centre, but where is that, where am I, where's the I? It was definitely felt like it was here. And I went and spoke to Tejananda afterwards in the meditation review, and I said, you know, I definitely had an experience of I, it was definitely there, you know, in the heart centre. And he said, oh, that's interesting, a lot of people report experiencing it behind their eyes, you know, sort of somewhere in the middle of their heads, that's where they identify it. And he said, well, just experiment and just see if it stays there, you know, see if that continues to be the case. And the next time I went and sat, I thought, where's the eye? And it had gone, you know, that whatever it was that was at the heart centre wasn't there anymore. And I thought, well, that's interesting, isn't it? You know, clearly this sense of me and I comes and goes. Anyway, it's worth experimenting in meditation, perhaps, or when you're walking around. And as I say, particularly when you're having a strong emotion, but when you're not as well, just, you know, just sort of see if you can get a sense of where the I is, where the sense of I is. But yeah, I mean, I think for most of us anyway, this sense that there is an I, even if we can't identify it, we talk about it, it's how we relate to the world, isn't it? That there is something called me that has a core, a permanent core. So this is what this school of Buddhism, the Madhyamaka school of Buddhism, is refuting and saying, absolutely not. This is completely not the case. This is our delusion. So everything, in a way, that we are exploring in this area through these teachings is to get at that, is to get at the sense that there is nothing permanent, particularly in people, in beings. So the Madhyamaka teachings also emphasize the Bodhisattva path as a way of both realizing this fundamental teaching of emptiness, shunyata, but also of sort of giving expression to it. And the Bodhisattva path is like a sort of the compassionate aspect of enlightenment. The Mahayana schools generally put forward the Bodhisattva as the ideal of the ideal Buddhist, the sort of the perfect way of being as a Buddhist, and the ideal way of practicing the Dharma and becoming enlightened. So if we're going back to the perfection of wisdom, it's one of either the six or the ten perfections that the Bodhisattva practices. And it's usually the last one, certainly in the six perfections, the six paramitas, the perfection of wisdom is the last one that's talked about usually. So you've probably come across the Bodhicharya Avatara. This is the classic text. It's a Madhyamaka text, and it sets out the six paramitas, and Shantideva, the author, talks about how to practice them, and the perfection of wisdom. There's a whole chapter devoted to that in the Bodhicharya Avatara. I don't know whether anyone's tried to read it, but yes. I don't find it very easy to understand, put it that way. But anyway, that's there. And you recognise other bits of the Bodhicharya Avatara if you're not familiar with it. If you've done our Sevenfold Puja, that's taken from the Bodhicharya Avatara. So the perfection of wisdom literature, which is the third meaning, if you like, of perfection of wisdom, the Praniparamita, is it's if you we could sort of think of it in terms of maybe being the wisdom aspect of enlightenment within this tradition. So you've got the Bodhisattva path as the compassion aspect, and the Praniparamita, perfection of wisdom literature, as being the wisdom aspect. So it's an exploration of non-self and insubstantiality, shunyata, very much. And some of the best known Buddhist texts come from this body of literature, like the Heart Sutra, for example, and the Diamond Sutra. And I believe that the Heart Sutra and the Diamond Sutra are the most chanted and most sort of well-known Buddhist texts in the whole Buddhist world. And they're chanted in all different Buddhist schools across Asia, including Tibet, including the Far East. You know, they're just very, very well known, and a lot of people know them off by heart. So apparently a lot of monks and nuns even know the Diamond Sutra off by heart, which is pretty amazing. Not just the Heart Sutra like us, but anyway. So if you've chanted the Heart Sutra, you'll know that one of the main characteristics of this body of literature is that it's quite difficult to grasp intellectually, even impossible to grasp intellectually, and it has a very sort of paradoxical kind of feel to it. So I will come back to the perfection of wisdom literature later on in the talk. So there we go, that's just by way of introduction. So I've called the talk Approaches to the Perfection of Wisdom, or Ways to Approach It. I mean, you could just have a go at reading the Perfection of Wisdom chapter in the Bodhicaryavatara, but I mean, I find it pretty impenetrable myself, but anyway, you can see how you get on. But I thought, rather than suggesting just that, maybe we could approach it through the traditional route of the threefold path, ethics, meditation and wisdom. So three different ways in, if you like, three different approaches to this perfection. So starting with ethics. If the perfection of wisdom is the view or the attitude that we're trying to sort of develop, this attitude of all things being insubstantial. I was thinking of what Padmasambhava says. He talks about descending with the view. He says, descend with the view and descend with the conduct, which to me sort of sounds like start at the top with the view and sort of try and chunk that down into action, or ascend with the conduct. Start at the bottom with the kind of action that you would like to, that would sort of express the view, and then sort of work your way up to the view through that. It's a bit like sort of acting as if you're enlightened. So from that point of view, I thought we could look at ethics a little bit. So, so if the perfection of wisdom is at one end of the scale of enlightenment, and the Buddha was said to have no view, so it's at the end, that end where there's no view, the unenlightened state, you could say, is wrong view. There's sort of the kind of our mind, my mind, would be imbued with wrong view. This idea that I'm me, I have a fixed and permanent core, and also the whole world revolves around me, that my happiness, my well-being is the most important thing in the universe, and that's really what I'm going about trying to ensure. I imagine most of us would sort of say that we, you know, that there's other things that are important to us, and also act in that way as well, as much as we can, but often when it comes down to it, you know, well, certainly I know that I do hold myself very dearly, and I do prioritise my own well-being with the best will in the world. So that's, if you like, that's how wrong view manifests in a way. This is where ethics begins, isn't it? It's from this place of, I suppose, a self-centred view of the universe. So any kind of ethical practice, we're trying to move away from that towards something which would be perhaps not the Buddha's end of it, which is no view at all, but to something like a staging post in between, which would be right view. Yeah. So, I mean, we've got the five precepts, haven't we, as a kind of a guideline for ethical conduct. But I was also thinking about, in a way, we could think of the perfections, the paramitas, as being precepts in a way. We could be trying to practice generosity, ethics, patience, energy in pursuit of the good, absorption, meditation, wisdom. We could, you know, you could even say that somebody who's unfailingly generous or ethical or patient or energetic and mindful has attained the perfection of wisdom. In a way, if you like, that would be the manifestation of the perfection of wisdom in practice. So to the extent that we are thinking of ourselves as trainee bodhisattvas or sort of people who are trying to manifest the bodhisattva spirit, we could just think in terms of practicing the paramitas, and in a way that would lead towards the perfection of wisdom without having to wrestle with Shantideva's chapter in the Bodhicharyavatam. You know, it sort of simplifies it a bit more. These things are a little bit easier to, you know, to grasp, I find, anyway. So when I was on the retreat that I was telling you about, I was thinking about this talk, and I thought, as a way of preparing for it, what I could do is just write every day for 10 minutes on the perfection of wisdom. You know, just like that sort of free writing where you don't edit or, you know, you don't sort of censor yourself or whatever. So this is what I wrote one day. If I was perfectly wise, how would that be? How would I be? Unruffled. Unruffled by things not being as they ought. Seeing ever more deeply into conditionality, knowing that things arise in dependence upon conditions and that they also fall away. And also that it's nobody's fault as such. We can see that X person's behaviour has an unhelpful or even distinctly harmful effect, but that's not the same as saying they're at fault. Which is quite interesting. I sort of went in that direction of thinking about that. Things not being as they ought to be, it's sort of, well, it kind of shows, doesn't it, how, you know, my mind would go towards then it's somebody's fault if things are not how they ought to be. Looking for blame, if you like. So when I was reading back, I thought, well, that's interesting, because that actually reads more, it's not like I'm talking about the perfection of wisdom. That's more like the perfection of patience, in the Bodhicharyavatara. That's, in a way, that was where my mind was going. If I was perfectly wise, I would be perfectly patient, which, yeah, kind of reinforces, I think, what I'm saying about the perfections as being a manifestation, if you like, of the other perfections being a manifestation of the perfection of wisdom. And I was just rereading what Shantideva actually says about the perfection of patience, which I think is really helpful. He says, even if one sees a friend or an enemy behaving badly, one can reflect that there are specific conditioning factors that determine this and thereby remain happy. So, just quite interesting. He's sort of just talking about conditionality applying to everything, even things that we don't like, you know, even to people's behaviour that we don't like. I thought it can be a helpful antidote to ill will. Not always an easy one, because certainly when I'm sort of in the middle of ill will, it's a bit like I was saying earlier on, I've got a strong sense of I've been done to by somebody, I have been done to by somebody. There's a very strong sense of me and them, you know, within that. But if I think about conditionality, if I think, well, you know, why is this person behaving the way they are, kind of thing, I don't need to take it personally. It's funny, you would think it would be very easy or very sort of attractive to think along those lines, to sort of let go of the ill will and to sort of be free of this sort of unpleasant feeling. And yet, I tend to find I've got a lot invested in not thinking like that, in sort of trying to find out why. In a sense, trying to justify myself blaming somebody for something. Part of me really wants to do that. Part of me really thinks that that's the answer, that that's going to make me happy. But actually, in fact, it's what makes me less happy. You know, it makes me more unhappy. So, yeah, so as I say, it's quite a simple thing. If you see a friend or an enemy behaving badly, one can reflect there are specific conditioning factors that determine this and thereby remain happy. How often do we do it, you know? I've been practicing nonviolent communication for a few years, doing various courses. I don't know whether many people here have done NVC. Has anyone done it? A few people have done it, so yeah, quite a lot of you have done it. So in NVC, we talk about people behaving in certain ways to meet their needs. Yeah, or we could sort of say, another way of putting it is that we've all got certain values that we hold dear, which are common to all of us, not just to some people, like autonomy or honesty or kindness or whatever it happens to be, feeling potent. So I think, you know, there is this teaching in NVC as well, isn't there? Whenever we act, or whenever anybody acts, if we look hard enough, we can detect one or other of these values underneath our actions. But we don't always find the best strategy to express the values. And sometimes some of us find strategies that are absolutely disastrous. You know, I mean, quite seriously disastrous, like murder, you know, and all sorts of horrific sort of violent acts. But, you know, in NVC, they would say that the people who practice NVC would say that, well, they would say that's a tragic expression of an a tragic way of trying to meet a need, a tragic strategy, a disastrous strategy to meet a need. So in a way, it's coming at the same sort of thing, this whole thing that, you know, if we look hard enough, we'll see there's conditions for why people act. It's not because, it's usually, if somebody does harm to me or does something bad to me, it's usually not got much to do with me. You know, I'm just on the receiving end of a disastrous strategy, which isn't, you know, isn't always pleasant, and it can be awful. But, you know, in a way, that's what we're looking at. And the perfection of patience would be to sort of see that unconditionally in everything that goes on, you know. And that would be an expression of the perfection of wisdom. So, you know, it is quite radical, actually. It's asking quite a lot of us, well, an awful lot. And if it's happening within ourselves, if it's our own strategies that are either disastrous or just a bit unhelpful, well, maybe one way that we can work with that is to, well, just to try and gain a deeper clarity and understanding on ourselves as practitioners, in what motivates us, what's going on for ourselves, get to sort of see what our patterns and tendencies are, what, you know, why we do what we do, and what it is we try and do, and what could be more helpful. And of course, you know, in order to do that, meditation is very important, and reflection, but particularly friendship, and, you know, the way we can reflect each other back. At the moment, I'm in the process of being discussed as a possible private preceptor. And one of the things that I have had to, I've been asked to do in as part of that process, is to invite friends who've known me for a number of years in different situations to give me feedback, to sort of say how they see me in relation to certain criteria, if you like. And it's absolutely fascinating. It's interesting what people will say, and it's interesting that a lot of people are saying the same things or similar things. There's certain things that, you know, two, three people have mentioned that, and then I'll have a discussion with someone today, and she said, oh, there was that particular thing you did. I said, oh yeah, somebody else mentioned that one as well, you know. So and I suppose what they're pointing at, if you like, is my strategies, some of which are not that helpful maybe, you know, which are underlying a real sort of desire to be understood, or a real desire for autonomy, or whatever it happens to be, you know. And I've got particular ways of doing that that, well, they don't always help me either, because I can come across in a way that I don't mean to, you know. So, but without that feedback, I mean, I kind of know that I have certain tendencies, but I think, oh, well, you know, just how I am sort of thing. But when you get the feedback, you sort of see it more clearly, I suppose. It's like sort of looking at yourself in the mirror. So, you know, I know a few of you in the ordination process, and I know it can feel a bit excruciating sometimes, getting feedback, but actually in my 12 years since ordination, I haven't had that sort of feedback. And I'm finding it incredibly helpful. I've sort of missed it in a way. It's great. While you get the chance, make the most of it, even if it is a bit uncomfortable at times, you know. And then I would say as well, if you've got other contexts where you can invite feedback or give it to each other, practice giving it, whether it's your GFR groups or whatever, it's really well worth making the most of it. You can learn so much, and that is actually what we're trying to do. You know, we're not going to be able to, go deeper within ourselves unless we do get a sense of what our tendencies are and how to find different strategies. That's fundamental to ourselves as practitioners, I would say. Anyway, I'll move on to meditation, keeping a little eye on the time. Gosh, I've been going on. Right. Yes. So, yeah, the second of those three strands, ethics, meditation, wisdom. So I'll just say a little bit about approaching the perfection of wisdom through meditation. Again, when I was on this retreat with Tejananda recently, he was talking about wisdom, jnana, as being undivided awareness, which I thought was a great simple sort of translation, if you like, simple explanation. So I was thinking, well, what is it that divides awareness? So what is it that comes into our minds that sort of, if you like, sort of makes us fragmented and divided? Well, you know, when we're meditating, we've got the hindrances, haven't we? You know, the craving for sense desire, ill will, anxiety, etc. So we're quite familiar with that formulation, probably. A Mahayana formulation, we could talk about the poisons, the five poisons being the things that divide awareness. So that craving, hatred, pride, envy and ignorance, or the first four, if you like, are a manifestation of ignorance, we could say. Any negative mental events, really, an unskillful action of body, speech and mind that would come from those poisons. So the perfection of wisdom is a practice. This is something else I asked Tejananda. I said, well, if jnana is undivided awareness, what's pranya then? And he said, oh, well, you could see it as that which unites awareness. Oh, well, that's neat as well. That's a nice little definition. So what is it that unites awareness? Well, presumably it's that which removes the poisons. You know, it's that which sort of works with those tendencies within our mind. Meditation's a very fundamental place for doing that, isn't it? And action, obviously, as well. But, you know, getting to grips with seeing our mind, seeing how it works. Meditation's one of the main places of doing it, isn't it? So I was thinking to myself, well, how do you do that? How do you sort of remove these poisons? And actually, I think, for me, the main thing to do is to notice it. Just sort of clock it and see it. And name it for what it is. Bring awareness and attention to it. Possibly focus on the sensation that accompanies it, any sort of feeling that accompanies it. But really, really importantly, try to let go of any story around it, because it's the stories that kind of perpetuate it, and, you know, kind of, if you like, the stories are trying to justify it, aren't they? But if we can be more with just the feeling, or the kind of whatever, you know, whatever sort of the kind of colour or the tone of these particular poisons in our body and in our mind, and really get a sense of them. Well, certainly in my experience, what can happen, or what often happens, is that after a bit, they just seem to fizzle out of their own accord, or that, you know, the mind moves on, it is impermanence at work. If you're not doing the stories, then you just go round and round and round, don't you? But if you're just sort of able to be with them, then something does just dissolve eventually, which I find quite an exciting way of practicing, quite an interesting way of practicing. So this sort of, if we can actually do something like this, particularly with an uncomfortable mental state, although I think it's also worth doing with things like craving as well, with strong desire, which might not always feel uncomfortable initially, might feel quite attractive, but I think it's still worth applying to that as well. But certainly with uncomfortable mental states, if we manage to stay with them in this kind of way and they do dissolve, well, what we're experiencing is shunyata. We're experiencing impermanence and insubstantiality. These things, that, you know, they don't have a core. They just dissolve. Yeah. Anyway, so that's one way, if you like, of approaching it through meditation. Just something you can go and try at home, if you like. And finally, approaching the perfection of wisdom through the wisdom route, directly through the wisdom route. So actually in the Bodhicharya Avatara, Shantideva, how he begins the chapter on the perfection of wisdom, he says, he calls it the perfection of understanding in this translation, he says, it is for the sake of understanding that the sage taught this entire collection of preparations. Therefore, in the desire to put an end to suffering, one should develop understanding. It is agreed that there are these two truths, the conventional and the ultimate. Reality is beyond the scope of intellection. Intellection is said to be the conventional. So we're back to what I said earlier on about moving from wrong view via right view to no view, if you like. Wrong view and right view, if you want, are both within the realm of the conventional reality or conventional truth, relative truth, and the no view, which is the perfection of wisdom or the mind of the Buddha, if you like, goes beyond what these translators called intellection, I suppose, intellectual formulation or using the intellect in order to understand. So it's really what he's saying is that the perfection of wisdom is beyond rational thought. It's not something we can understand with our rational minds. So, I mean, I'm sure that you're familiar with this, with the Heart Sutra. I mean, when I first learned to chant the Heart Sutra, it was an interesting mixture of something that just didn't seem to make much sense, and I found it rather irritating at the time, but that also had an impact somewhere on a deeper level. It kind of, when I've asked people about the Heart Sutra in classes and things, I've asked what their responses are. Invariably, people say that it's, you know, on some level it's a bit baffling and they don't necessarily like it or whatever, but there's something that they respond to on a deeper level. So, I mean, in a way, that's kind of the direction that we're going with the sort of wisdom aspect. It's beyond the rational mind, but it hits home. It feels true, or there's something about it, you know, that grasps us. I've written here that it's full of paradox, if not what would appear to be gobbledygook. like the Heart Sutra, form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't seem to mean anything. I suppose you could kind of explain it and say, oh, well, it means this, but, you know, on a particular level, it is deliberately paradoxical, isn't it? So all of the perfection of wisdom literature has this kind of characteristic. And in Wisdom Beyond Words, Bhante, there's this record of three seminars that Bhante gave on the Heart Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, and the Ratnaguna Samchayagatha, which is three of the main perfection of wisdom texts. But apparently there's, I don't know how many perfection of wisdom texts, but there's lots and lots and lots of them. So, you know, these are three of many, if you like. The Diamond Sutra, as I said, and the Heart Sutra are probably the best known texts in the Buddhist world. And the Diamond Sutra, I don't know whether many of you know the Diamond Sutra or have read it, but it's very important to our tradition, to the Triratna tradition, because many of you know that when Bhante read it, age 16, he understood it to be true and knew he was a Buddhist and always had been, which is absolutely amazing, I think, when you read the Diamond Sutra. I thought I might give you an extract of the Diamond Sutra to show how amazing this could be. The Lord said, if any bodhisattva would say, I will create harmonious Buddha fields, he would speak falsely. and why. The harmonies of Buddha fields, the harmonies of Buddha fields, Subhuti, as no harmonies have they been taught by the Tathagata. Therefore, he spoke of harmonious Buddha fields. Here's another one. Suppose, Subhuti, there were a man endowed with a huge body, so that he had a personal existence like Sumeru, king of mountains. Would that, Subhuti, be a huge personal existence? Subhuti replied, yes, huge, O Lord, huge, O well gone, would his personal existence be. And why so? Personal existence, as no existence has that been taught by the Tathagata. For not, O Lord, is that existence or non-existence. Therefore, which is called personal existence. I love it. When I read it, it always makes me laugh. And I think if you're a scholar, it does make sense. But, you know, if you're not a scholar, you think, what on earth is all this about? And how could anybody reading it realise they were a Buddhist? But it's a funny thing, because what Banti says about it is, he says, what we have in the Diamond Sutra is a comprehensible but irrelevant meaning with a further significance or purport that is relevant but is not comprehensible. It is not difficult to get at the meaning of the sentences, but to get at what I'm calling the purport, the direction in which the words are pointing above and beyond the verbal meaning, is much more difficult. What we may be sure of is that we can only get at the purport by constantly bearing the meaning in mind. One way to do this is to recite the words constantly, repeating certain short verses over and over again. If we repeat the comprehensible but irrelevant words often enough, as monks have been doing for hundreds of years in the monasteries of Japan and the lamasteries of Tibet, something of the purport will begin to dawn on us. So I don't know whether you've had this experience with, well, the Heart Sutra. So I'm guessing that most of you know the Heart Sutra. But it is interesting, because I have had two experiences with the Perfection of Wisdom literature, which seems to be the sort of thing that Banti's talking about. With the Heart Sutra particularly, when I first came along, I just sort of chanted it like everybody else, but you know, gradually it sort of grew on me, but I don't think I could have told you what it meant at all, actually. I don't even think I could have told you what the scholars say it's about, you know. Shortly after I first came along, a friend of mine, her mother was dying, she was in a hospice, and I went to visit her, and I remember very strongly sort of being with this dying woman, and then going out, and it was a very beautiful day, it was in May or June or something, and the weather was absolutely perfect, and there was a breeze blowing, and all these beautiful flowers, and the Heart Sutra just came to mind, you know, form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. It's almost like it came up from somewhere, because I knew it off by heart, it just sort of came up from somewhere and erupted in that context. It's very, very strong, it really sort of had quite an effect, actually. And since then, I've kind of had a bit more of a sense of the intuitive meaning of it, that kind of gut level. Well, clearly, I did, you know, something had resonated, even though, as I say, intellectually, rationally, I couldn't have said much, you know, I couldn't have explained what it was about. And with the Diamond Sutra, which I think is even more difficult to get to the bottom of than the Heart Sutra, we were doing, on the convention a couple of years ago, we were having, there was a session every afternoon where Dharma texts were being read out loud, and you just sort of sat and listened, and they were reading the Diamond Sutra, and I was sitting there listening to it, and I wasn't really very focused. I was sort of shifting around a bit and not very comfortable, and getting a bit, oh God, it goes on and on, doesn't it? None of it really makes much sense, and getting a bit fed up with it in some ways. And then it came to the last four lines, which is what I've given you, these little bits of paper. So it goes on like this about, you know, huge personal existences, and it isn't this and it isn't that, therefore it's this, you know, all the way through. And then it comes to the end, and it says this thing of a stars, a fault of vision as a lamp, a moksha, dewdrops or a bubble, a dream, a lightning flash or cloud, so should one view what is conditioned. And I burst into tears. I was just in floods of tears at this point, having been pretty bored all the way through this reading. And just, you know, sort of hit by, I was like being hit by a thunderbolt or something. It was an odd experience. It was really odd. But I think if I'd gone and sat down and somebody had just read that to me, it wouldn't have had the same effect. It was because it had come at the end of all this other stuff that it penetrated. So it's quite interesting. And maybe that explains why they chant it rather than read it, you know, in these monasteries and lamasteries. Maybe it has more of an effect if it's read aloud or something. So, yeah, so actually in the Diamond Sutra, earlier on in the Diamond Sutra, again, you know, in the middle of all this paradoxical stuff, there's a sentence where it says, "Thereupon, the impact of the Dharma moved the Venerable Subhuti to tears," which is, it's funny. So, you know, there's something in it, isn't there? So that's why I've given you these four lines. I mean, you may know them anyway, you may have come across them, but I thought we could look at them next week when we do the follow-up from this. Well, they're not at all incomprehensible or difficult to penetrate like the rest of most of the rest of the Heart Sutra, the Diamond Sutra. They're sort of limpid and poetic and these beautiful images. And I would say they're well worth memorising and quite easy to memorise. So in a way, this is how I would suggest, you know, for us at our level, how to approach the wisdom aspect, if you like, of the perfection of wisdom, which was by reading and learning and reciting the whole of the Heart Sutra and these bits of the Diamond Sutra and any other perfection of wisdom texts that appeal to us, learning bits by heart and just sort of reciting them to ourselves or, you know, with a group of friends or whatever, and just allowing them to penetrate. And they become a resource, you know, to reflect on. So, I believe we're going to finish with a mantra, which I'll start. Maybe I'll bring in the perfection of wisdom, the Pranaparamita goddess at this point, because we could do that. But before I do that, I thought perhaps we could just sit and I would just read you these lines a couple of times and just let them have an effect, and then I'll start the Pranaparamita mantra. Om Adi Hum Swaha. 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 Om Adi.
Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om Adi Hum Swaha. Om.